Hello, and welcome to Science World. NASA's Messenger, the first spacecraft to orbit Mercury, ended its 11-year mission when it ran out of fuel and crashed into its surface on Thursday. Ann Ball will tell us more. George Buttigieg tells us about a new multi-camera studio developed at Pittsburgh's Carnegie Mellon University that captures motion in 3D and will bring video analysis to an exceptional new level. And late last fall, University of Washington climate scientist Nick Bond noticed a big patch of water in the Pacific Ocean just off the West Coast that was warmer than the surrounding waters. Bond and his colleagues believe that this warm patch of water may have played a part of Washington State's mild 2014 winter, could indicate a warmer than usual summer, and is impacting marine life along the West Coast. He joins us to talk about his team's research and findings. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology Magazine, Science World. The first spacecraft to orbit Mercury ended its 11-year mission when it ran out of fuel and crashed into its surface on Thursday at 1926 Universal Time. Science World's Ann Ball has more on the Messenger mission.
NASA's half-ton orbiter, known by its acronym Messenger, was launched in August 2004 on a mission to Mercury, the planet closest to the Sun. Messenger studied the planet's chemical composition, geology, and magnetic field. The Messenger spacecraft soared through the inner solar system for 7 years before reaching its destination. Placing Messenger into orbit proved to be a challenging task to mission technicians and engineers due to the sun's gravity, intense heat, and effects of solar radiation pressure. Among other scientific data it gathered, Messenger discovered the presence of frozen water in deep craters sitting in permanent shadow. It also found a mysterious dark matter that could consist of organic compounds. During its last month in orbit, Messenger sent back to NASA the best high-resolution images so far of Mercury's desolate, moon-like surface. For Science World, I'm Ann Ball.
A new shipment of supplies was expected at the International Space Station this week, but the delivery spacecraft carrying the goods was unable to make it to the ISS after a problem developed shortly after launch. Science World's Philip Alexio has more.
Russian space officials said this week that they've lost control of the unmanned Progress spacecraft that was launched Tuesday from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. They also said that the ship is now spinning toward Earth. On Wednesday, Igor Komarov, head of Russia's Roscosmos space agency, provided a statement regarding the status of the unmanned supply capsule.
При этом вследствие
For security reasons, continued flights of the spacecraft and its docking at the ISS is not possible at present. Currently, we're trying to control the functioning of the systems on board, and we're putting a plan in place so that the spacecraft falls into the ocean. Officials did not immediately say why the flight failed. The failed cargo ship is expected to burn up as it re-enters Earth's atmosphere. Progress was to have brought food and other supplies to the International Space Station. In an email to Science World, NASA said that the spacecraft was not carrying any supplies critical for the United States operating segment of the station. The space agency reassures that both the Russian and the U.S. operating segments of the station are continuing to operate normally and are adequately supplied well beyond the next planned resupply flight. The next mission scheduled to deliver cargo to the station, according to NASA, is the seventh SpaceX Commercial Resupply Services mission that is targeted for launch no earlier than June 19th. It will carry about 2,300 kilograms of science investigations and supplies. The loss of the Progress spacecraft is the second cargo flight to fail in the past year. A ship was destroyed last October when its rocket exploded on the launch pad in Virginia. For Science World, I'm Philip Alexio.
Earlier this year, the first ever biodegradable surgical glue for use inside the body won approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Roseanne Skirbel reports on the innovation and its journey from research to market.
Tissue glue came about by accident, says University of Pittsburgh engineering professor Eric Beckman. Around 2001, he and a dental surgeon at the University of Pittsburgh were working on a problem in the lab.
The research was on something that quite frankly, has nothing to do with tissue glue.
The colleagues had set out to design a tissue regeneration membrane. In the process, they stumbled on a sticky, glue-like substance.
The substance at the time in the lab was a science project. It was a laboratory material. Tissue glue is orders of magnitude more sophisticated.
Tissue glue is a non-toxic version of a chemical compound used to make plastic. Surgeons would use it to connect big flaps of skin and tissue inside the body. Beckman says they saw an opportunity to develop and market tissue glue because while medical adhesives and liquid bandages were becoming increasingly popular, nothing like that existed for internal use. In 2006, Beckman took an entrepreneurial year leave of absence from the university and co-founded Cohera Medical. Cohera raised $75 million to bring tissue glue to market. The clinical trials proved it was strong, safe, and effective. Surgeons work with a three-prong preloaded handheld device that steadily administers uniform drops of the adhesive. This year, Beckman says the product won approval from the Food and Drug Administration to be used to attach large skin flaps in an operation that removes excess fat and skin. Beckman says the adhesive also helps reduce fluid buildup by holding tissues close together.
The way it works is that if you can eliminate dead space between tissue planes by using tissue glue, we've shown in our clinical trial that there's a strong potential to send patients home without having surgical drains. Until tissue glue came along, they were the standard of care because you have to manage the fluid that builds up. But they're not very pleasant for anyone.
The new glue also means fewer complications and a more rapid recovery for the patient. In Europe, it's been approved for use in breast cancer and lymph node dissection surgeries. Cohera is working on another sealant for bowel surgery. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for the Science World Quick Quiz. Well, we just heard about the development of new medical adhesive. So, speaking of adhesives used for medical purposes, what year was the popular Band-Aid bandage invented? Was it in A, 1909, B, 1933, or C, 1920? Think about it. We'll have the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
Listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
This year's Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement is being awarded to two scientists who have worked for conservation on the land and in the ocean. Michael Sullivan tells us more from Los Angeles.
Bamboo crops in the Western Ghats, a mountain range in Western India, have been depleted by the paper industry, and Madhav Gadgil says that hurts local villagers who rely on the plants to make baskets and other products. Gadgil was trained at Harvard University and is now a visiting professor at India's Goa University, where he works with villagers to keep the ecosystem balanced and let the bamboo groves flourish.
Earlier, they were exploited through the state machinery and largely they were auctioned off to industries. Now the communities have rights to manage these.
He says that for generations, villagers have preserved parts of the forest as sacred, something that also happens in other parts of Asia. Gadgil says he serves as a bridge between local people and government, which wants to promote modern management techniques.
Documenting these sacred forests kind of biodiversity resources that have been conserved, what is the traditional motivation, what is now in the current context possible.
Professor Godgill traveled to Los Angeles to receive the prestigious Tyler Prize and to meet this year's other winner, Jane Lubchenco. A marine ecologist, she teaches at Oregon State University and served 4 years as the head of the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Last year, President Barack Obama named her U.S. Science Envoy for the Ocean. Lubchenco has worked with American fishermen to restore depleted fisheries through a program called Catch Shares, which grants fishing rights to fishermen but puts limits on their catch in affected areas.
Our basic ideas of oceans is that they are so immense, so bountiful, that we could take anything out and put anything in and it wouldn't make much of a difference. And we've discovered that's simply not the case.
The system of catch shares gives fishermen a share of the ocean harvest, and those rights can be bought, sold, and traded. The system has its critics, but Lubchenco and other supporters point to its success in restoring depleted stocks. She says that limiting fishing on the high seas is difficult.
There are a lot of efforts underway to rein in overfishing, but it remains a huge challenge, and it has global ramifications.
She says governments must lead and local communities must be part of the solution. Madhav Godgill says the same is true of the Indian villagers with whom he works.
They have a substantial amount of understanding, local understanding of that resource base and what is impacting it, what might be good sustainable use practices.
The prize winners say the balance of life in the ocean and on the land is essential for a healthy planet and healthy communities. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You may have heard of 3D printing, where three-dimensional objects are printed by a machine that deposits a plastic-type material, usually layer by layer, to form a solid object. Now researchers at the University of Michigan have developed what they call a 4D medical device that is customized for very young patients and changes as their young bodies grow. Art Chimes has the details.
The Michigan researchers focused on children with a rare condition called tracheobronchomalacia, or TBM. The disease weakens the walls of the airway, which can collapse, starving the child of oxygen. One of the researchers, Dr. Glenn Green, told reporters that TBM is a devastating condition. The three children in this pilot study had been hospitalized in an intensive care unit for months.
During that time, to stay alive, they required heavy sedation, narcotics, and even paralytics. They all had tracheostomies, where a breathing tube was placed through their necks and were on artificial ventilators. There was no cure, and life expectancies for each of these children were grim.
Patients with TBM have been treated with a splint that surrounds the airway and supports and protects it, just like a broken arm can be supported by a splint. But young children grow quickly, and the airway would soon outgrow a standard splint. So the 3D printed splint, customized for each patient, is designed to expand over the fourth dimension, time. Several years after being implanted, when the airway becomes strong enough to resist collapsing, the 3D splint is gradually absorbed by the body. Two of the children in this study were much improved. A third suffered no complications, but is still on a ventilator, presumably because of other issues. And Dr. Green says 3D printing can help surgeons as well as patients.
We actually printed the patient's airway, the trachea and bronchi beforehand. And by printing this ahead of time, then we were able to practice the operation before we actually incised the child's chest to go in and save their lives.
Megan Frisk, an editor at the journal Science Translational Medicine, which published Green's paper, said the findings
represent not only a new surgical option for patients suffering from obstructive airway diseases, but also show the promise for 4D printed materials in medicine.
The researchers are planning a larger study of this 3D printed implantable airway splint in children with TBM. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
Sports coaches often use video cameras to analyze athletes' movements in order to improve their performance. A new multi-camera studio developed at the Carnegie Mellon University promises to bring video analysis to an unprecedented level. George Putich has the report.
In 1878, using 12 still cameras positioned along a racetrack, English photographer Edward Maybridge solved a much-debated question whether a galloping horse had all of its legs in the air at one point. 137 years later, using more than 500 cameras, scientists at Carnegie Mellon University captured the motion of a baseball batter's swing in unprecedented 3D detail. In a two-story dome made of 20 hexagons called the Panoptic Studio, 30 high-definition video cameras plus 480 additional cameras record the same motion from different angles. Carnegie Mellon computer scientist Hyun-Bul Ju says a computer turns those images into detailed 3D analysis of the motion.
The main purpose of this system is to analyze very interesting dynamic movement or dynamic scenes, such as sports players' motion.
At any given moment, the system captures more than 100,000 points of motion, requiring 120 computer hard drives, as just 1 minute of such a video takes up about 500 gigabytes of memory. A sophisticated algorithm identifies only videos from cameras that see the points relevant to the target. Once those videos are integrated and converted into a full 3D reconstruction of the movement, the algorithm creates a detailed pattern of the motion.
Using our system, we can compare those movements so that we can see how to teach the right motion to people.
Scientists say the Panoptic Studio can be useful for analyzing and correcting any kind of movements or behavior. As for large sports arenas and other events, researchers say they may be able to develop an algorithm that uses the same technique by capturing videos from hundreds of spectators' cameras. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Do you have the correct answer for this week's Science World Quick Quiz? Well, let's find out. In what year was the popular Band-Aid bandage invented? Was it in A, 1909, B, 1933, or C, 1920? The answer is C. According to the Band-Aid brand Adhesive Bandages website, the Band-Aid was invented in 1920 by Earl Dixon, a cotton buyer at Johnson & Johnson, a U.S. health product manufacturing company. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Back during the fall and then winter of 2013-2014, University of Washington climate scientist Nick Bond noticed a big and nearly circular patch of Pacific Ocean water just off the west coast that didn't cool off as much as it normally did. Since this warmer-than-usual patch of water didn't have a name, Bond began to call it the Blob. Bond thinks that the blob may have played a part of Washington State's mild 2014 winter and could indicate a warmer-than-usual summer. Scientists from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, along with Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans, joined Bond to learn more about the blob. Nick Bond joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about the blob and its influence on weather and marine life along the West Coast.
The blob itself, and what I really got fascinated in, was this circular patch of warm water that developed off the coast of the Pacific Northwest in the winter of 2013-2014. And I got so interested in it because the water was so much warmer than normal, and it was in a place that we usually don't see temperature anomalies of that magnitude.
Do you have any possible causes for the formation of this phenomenon? Does climate change have anything to do with it?
No, it doesn't look like it's climate change per se. It was a weird weather pattern, unusually light winds and from a different direction than usual. And how it formed was that Mostly it was because less heat was being drawn up from the ocean into the atmosphere, and to a certain extent also kind of warmer water was moving into the region from the south. So it was kind of part of the same weird weather patterns that caused drought in California. Some cold weather in the eastern U.S. was responsible for the blob.
Let me reverse it. So is the blob doing any controlling of the weather, such as you mentioned, the drought and perhaps the extreme cold in eastern United States?
No, the blob on the large scale is mostly a result rather than a cause of the weather. It does have some secondary effects on temperatures right along the Pacific coast, especially western Washington, western Oregon, and that sort of thing. The prevailing winds are from the west, and so since that air has been going over warmer water, it's been kind of warmed and humidified to a certain extent, but we basically have to blame the atmosphere for making the blob rather than the reverse.
What about other impacts on the environment, such as wildlife and marine life?
Oh, yeah, there's big impacts there, and that is something that's kind of abiding interest and going to be future work also. It turns out that a lot of the species along the west coast of North America do better when the water is cold, and when the water is warmer than normal, the kind of base of the food chain isn't as productive, and the organisms that are there aren't as nutritious. It's kind of like eating rice cakes rather than potato chips. And so there's repercussions all up the food chain.
Is this something similar to the weather phenomena we know as El Nino or La Nina?
This relates to the kind of the formation of the weird weather that caused the blob. And there it's something that's sort of akin to El Nino and La Nina, but kind of a different sort of thing. And in particular, a colleague of mine, Dennis Hartman, has shown that what was going on in the far western tropical Pacific around New Guinea, warm waters there and large masses of thunderstorms had this ripple effect downstream, kind of like El Nino has a ripple effect over much of the globe. And so at least to a large extent, we can attribute the weird weather to what was going on in the far western tropical Pacific.
You mentioned that this was found in the winter of 2013. How did you discover it?
I'm the climatologist for the state of Washington, and we were having weird weather along the west, and I was kind of going, wow, this is really something. And then a lot of my research has to do with air-sea interactions, and I couldn't help but notice that the water was just much warmer in this spot off the Pacific Northwest than we'd have really ever seen before for that time of year. And so that kind of got my interest going in it and in kind of looking at just what mechanisms were responsible for it.
Is this phenomenon stationary or does it move about?
That's a good question. And since I really concentrated on last winter, but the pattern has kind of morphed this winter. And so it's no longer a blob, but more a strip of warmer water than normal along the entire coast of West North America, from Baja, California, up into the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea. And so the currents have moved it around, and moreover, the weird weather that we've had this past winter also helped cause this warming to be more along the coast. In that regards, it's probably even more impactful on the marine ecosystem because, again, as I mentioned, a lot of the organisms there do better when the water is cold.
That was University of Washington climate scientist and Washington State climatologist Nick Bond. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our webpage and blog. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Our web address is voanews.com/science. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.